You're listening to Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast. Mostly people just walking wordlessly while interesting music plays, but periodically punctuated by stark violence. Much like the work of our focus today, the writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson, known for films like There Will Be Blood, Magnolia, Boogie Nights, Punch Drunk Love, and his new one, One Battle After Another. I'm Mark Lintzenmeyer, lovable despite my obvious flaws.
I'm Al Baker, and I just think it's so refreshing to see a movie about black, empowered, revolutionary women made entirely by and for white men.
Oh, good call. Oh, my goodness.
I'm Sarah Lynn Breck, and Paul Thomas Anderson is my second favorite PTA, just below parent-teacher associations, but way above post-traumatic amnesia.
Wow. This is Lawrence Ware, and I drink your milkshake.
Nice.
All right. We've had quite a while to prep for this. Since we slotted in another topic secretly, Lawrence and I did. So I had a chance to watch a lot of movies that I hadn't watched before. I don't know that I'd really put together, you know, he's not like Scorsese, who's so well known and you know all of his movies. You know, if you told me that, what's the one?
Is it Punch Drunk Love? Because I think about once every 3 years, I get surprised that Paul Thomas Anderson directed Punch Drunk Love.
I watch it every single year. I mean, Magnolia, you know, Phantom Thread, There Will Be Blood. Which one is it, Mark? What are you trying to remember?
If you told me some David O. Russell film was a Paul Thomas Anderson film, okay, I Heart Huckabees. That's the one I was trying to remember.
Oh, yeah.
But now, through this review, I feel, you know, clarified. I see the through lines. Interesting guy.
Mm-hmm.
What is y'all's history with these? I mean, I'd seen a lot of these movies before and just not the last couple.
Yeah, I'll go first because, you know, I really love Paul Thomas Anderson and I do have one particularly scathing take about the latest movie and it makes it very interesting. But there are a lot of days on which There Will Be Blood, if you ask me, I would say is my favorite movie. And there are even some days
of all time.
Of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It really ranks up there. I didn't rewatch it specifically for this because I watch it fairly regularly anyway. And every time I see it, it completely blows me away. But Paul Thomas Anderson as a filmmaker, I don't love his entire canon nearly as much as I love There Will Be Blood. And that's because he's got this really, despite, as you say, Mark, there's some, you know, threads throughout it. He's got this incredibly diverse canon of films and all of them are really solid pieces of work. But I'm interested to talk about his idiosyncrasies. And yeah, I don't know most of his catalogue as nearly as well as I know one or two of his films that I absolutely love.
Magnolia is the one I really associated with him. And oh, bunch of plots coming together with these sort of quirky characters and, you know, some sad stuff in there. And music videos. He really likes shooting music videos. Mm-hmm. And so there are portions of all these films that are basically just music videos. Sarah, what's your...
Oh, gosh. I have a very complicated relationship with PTA. I was so excited after watching Boogie Nights. I was excited. This was a film director who was, you know, Gen X. He was talking about things that, you know, I wanted to talk about. And then when Magnolia came out, Josh and I saw that in the theater when we were still living in Chicago. And we were so disappointed. Mm. We were so mad at him for making that movie. We thought it was too long. We just hated it. And then he came back with Punch Drunk Love, and I loved that movie. And I also liked There Will Be Blood. The Master and Inherent Vice, those two just confused the crap out of me. I was less thrilled with Licorice Pizza. And then he came back with One Battle After Another. And so I don't know where I stand with him. I think some of his stuff is just brilliant, and I absolutely admire that he swings for the fences every single time. So I like him as an artist, but I don't like all of his work.
Lawrence, take it away.
I, for the most part, love Paul Thomas Anderson. I've seen all of his movies in the theater, even Hard Eight. They came out in 1996. I saw that in the theater. That's the first time I was introduced to him. Wasn't really taken by that film, but I saw some promise. Boogie Nights I loved. Magnolia I absolutely loved. I own that on CD. I own it now on 4K Blu-ray. I own it streaming. Love Magnolia. Love Punch Drunk Love. That's my favorite movie probably in my top 10 of all time. I really love that. I loved all his movies. I loved Master, Inherent Vice, Phantom Thread. Didn't like Licorice Pizza. That felt a little off to me. Didn't love this one very much, particularly for part of something that's already been said. We'll talk more about that. But one of the things that I think he does well, he does a really good job of getting great performances out of his actors. He's really good mm-hmm. with Tom Cruise in Magnolia. He's really good with really all those actors in Boogie Nights. He's even very good with Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love. Yeah. He's really good
yeah.
with his actors. He's really good because that's something I didn't know that Adam Sandler had in him. And this is like a Paul Thomas Anderson version of an Adam Sandler film. So I really enjoy that. One of the things that he does well is his direction is really good. He's really assured. He's good with the camera. He moves it very well. The kinetic pace of his films are oftentimes very good. What he doesn't do well is what he failed on this most recent film. He doesn't do race well, and he doesn't do politics well. And he tried to do both of those things in this film, and that's the reason why I didn't love this one as much. We can talk more about that, because Al's already kind of hinted at my criticism of this film. But Paul Thomas Anderson, as a filmmaker, as an artist, he's really, really good. He has some real drawbacks. When he's good, he's great.
So I was struck, I guess his early stuff. I hadn't realized that I'd seen Hard Eight until I rewatched it, and like, oh, I have seen this. I know what's going to happen. That he started out sort of trying to be Scorsese, but then developed his own thing. And his last bunch of them all seem to be novels for the screen, right? Which you usually associate at this point with like a prestige television series. But he seems to be able...
Was Licorice Pizza a novel? I don't know if that
No, I'm just saying they're presented as if...
Yeah.
The way that they're structured...
Novelistic?
Yes, they're very novelistic.
Yeah. They're kind of literary.
Yeah. Literary is a really good term.
Even Punch Drunk Love, which is not that long... But it's the way that it is filled out. I don't know. There's a lot of other directors, a lot of artsy directors. I refer to just long scenes of, oh, you got to get in Hard Eight him walking up all those hotel stairs. Like, you can't miss one of those stairs. It just seems a little weirdly self-indulgent. But for some reason, I like the way that he does it. Maybe it's his music choices better than some other directors that I get impatient with.
I don't remember. What was the adjective you just used?
Novelistic?
Literary?
No, the less flattering one. She was like long drawn.
Self-indulgent?
Self-indulgent, there we go. Or you call self-indulgent, I would maybe call more Charis would be cinematic, because it feels like what he is really interested in doing. I think this is where the literary analogy is really, really insightful, because one thing that he's really interested in doing is telling stories about people in ways other than through having them talk about how they're feeling. So like, this is the thing that I love most about There Will Be Blood. First 15 minutes, no dialogue. It's all just the pure physicality and different ways of showing like the fortitude and the will of this character through the screen without having him talk to anyone. And that's a remarkable cinematic achievement. And that's the kind of thing you would see in a great novel, is you'd have a chapter exploring the character of this person just by the way that they went about performing a particular job without having them have to talk about it necessarily. And that's the kind of expression that Paul Thomas Anderson seems to be really interested in doing, and I think does incredibly well.
I agree.
I guess let's start with the new film, at least briefly. I really enjoyed it. It really kept moving for me. I feel like he has matured as a filmmaker. Again, still had the quality of somewhat of a novel, but it was an actual action film. And I thought done in a pretty darn interesting way, the way the car chases were done. Like, I've just never seen car chases done.
Car chases were great.
That was so great. Yeah.
Long distant car chases. You can't see who you're chasing.
I grew up in California and I wasn't able to recognize where a lot of that stuff was shot. And from what I've learned is that he kind of went to all of these different kind of rural corners of California that nobody really knows where they are. I mean, I guess now people know where they are, but I was really surprised he could actually find corners of California that I was not familiar with at all.
It's an incredibly technically proficient film.
Technical, yes. Technically, it's really good.
It's why it's, I think, really interesting to talk about, because there is a stretch, for me at least, there's this weird gap between conception and execution. And this is a movie which is flawlessly executed, but there are some questions about what he thought he was doing.
Absolutely right.
Which I really want to dive into. The action is incredible. The setup for telling the story is incredible. The choice of subject matter is inspired in our current moment to tell exactly this kind of story is fantastic. I want to ask Lawrence directly this question, because I want to hear what he has to say about it. But Lawrence, why do you think in a movie which is ostensibly about a real, historically accurate, very impressive Black revolutionary woman, is most of the action of the movie following two schlubby old actors wandering around?
I have no idea.
Trying and to react that, to their weird fetishized yeah. relationships with her.
I don't know. It bothered me to no end. And I've read that book. And the woman in the book is a white woman. He made the choice to make her a Black woman and then do all this fetishizing and over-sexualization. I think that he thinks he's making a comment on that, but he is failing miserably to make that comment sufficiently, right? And so, Al, I'm telling you, man, I have no idea. Because you're right. Technically, this movie is so flawlessly made. It is wonderful direction. He's probably going to get nominated for an Oscar. I wouldn't be surprised if other people didn't get nominated for acting. I forgot her name. The young lady, the daughter.
Oh, Charity.
Charity. Yeah. Yes. She's really good. And I would not be surprised at all if she's nominated for supporting actress or something like that. She's really, really good. But man.
Everyone's really, really good.
Everyone's great. Yeah. The characters are up. Again, flawlessly executed. The characters are all great.
He's really good with actors. He's really good at bringing out.
Sorry, Chase Infinity. That's her name. Yeah.
He's really good at bringing out of actors their best performances. But man, what was he doing? I don't know what he was doing. And it frustrated me to no end because I'm sitting there with people who are film critics and they're having a good time and they're enjoying themselves. And I'm sitting there fuming because I know that history. Like, I know the history of Black revolutionary stuff. You know, I know the history of Black women, all that kind of stuff. I was so frustrated with this movie because it is a well-made movie. It is a well-acted movie. The script is pretty good, but damn, what was he doing? Because he just dropped the ball when it came to the politics and the racial elements of this and the fetishizing of Black women and an over-sexualization. It really bothered me so much. This is my least favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. And that's saying a lot because I fucking hated Inherent Vice. Like, I hated that movie.
But we'll get to that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so I really don't, Al, I'm saying, I don't know. And so I saw the Love Fest that was happening, but I noticed there was a lot of white critics saying that.
Yeah.
The Black people that I was talking to, the Black critics, they did not love this movie at all. So I don't know, man. I don't know, Al. I don't know what to make of this film.
So some of the women in Inherent Vice are also like, oh, this is my long lost love. This is definitely from the point of view of the Joaquin Phoenix character. And is she actually even returning? It's definitely from his point of view, very literally, like that he might be hallucinating whole characters. And so that's kind of how I was seeing the Teyana Taylor character in this is.
Oh,
is
I didn't.
She, not that she's imaginary, but just that she is being set as the fetishized other that is hovering on the background and haunts their lives. And we're not really, even in the part of the movie that she's in, we don't really see why she does what she does. Like that decision, like, I just got to be free. Yeah. I got to blow up my family. Like, nobody's going to sympathize with that. But yet people have acted like that. And it could have been a story about her and why she did that and her reconnecting with her daughter and stuff. But that's just not the book, I guess.
So this particular movie is told in those three distinct parts. And I thought the first part was supposed to be her story. The second part was Leonardo DiCaprio's story. And then the third part was Chase Infinity's story. So it was very distinct. I don't think that he was wholly successful with Teyana Taylor's story because there was actually, I think it's a really interesting choice. And also, I am a white lady, but I thought it was an interesting choice to have a character who is a revolutionary. She is aggressive. She has power. She has all of these wonderful, wonderful qualities. And she's so powerful. And then she has a baby. And then she has probably postpartum depression. We don't actually quite know yet because he doesn't really delve too deeply into her decision-making as you just, you know, established. And I thought that there was so much there. And if he had just gone a little bit further and really kind of dug into her character a little bit more, it would have been rounder and she would have actually had a better arc. But because he didn't, she was just in the end, you know, the way that her comrades talked about her was just that she was a rat. And I was like, oh God, you know, I didn't think that's what the message of that character was supposed to be.
And I was confused by the fact that her reputation in the, because they didn't, it felt like I missed the scene because they didn't do a whole lot to establish like what that happened. Hearing you guys talk about it really clarifies for me that, yeah, maybe it was just, because I was saying flawlessly executed, maybe there was a real miss in the tone, because you guys are absolutely right. If the whole thing had just been a bit more heightened, a bit more Coen Brothers-y, because there were gestures towards that, especially in the villain's arc and how kind of absurd that got in places.
Yeah.
And the Christmas Adventures Club was very kind of cartoonish.
Yeah.
And if the whole thing had kind of been a bit more heightened in that kind of way, maybe it would have felt less weird, but elements of the story just felt so grounded and felt like it was supposed to be, no, this is, you know, just what's happening, really, not a heightened perspective on a weird event, but like a realistic portrayal of what's supposed to be happening.
With like the message of it being very similar to Andor, like what I loved about Andor, you know, is that this is something that is going to be ongoing. You have a small piece of it. You may never reap the rewards of this revolution. And I could see seeds of that being planted. I just wanted to see it, you know, come through.
Yeah. And it kind of drips into this weird kind of fantasy as well, because there's this, like, in what world 30 years on are there still cells of this fringe revolutionary movement in the 70s who are still set up to handle exfiltrations and passwords and all of this kind of stuff. I was happy to go along for the ride, hearing you guys talk about it now, and now realize I wasn't entirely clear about how it was supposed to take a lot of what was going on screen.
Was the timeline supposed to be clear? When actually was the flashback?
It's now. It's supposed to be now.
So it's now, but then the flashback was to the 80s then or something.
Wait, no, because when Willa was born was 15 years before. That was all happening like
the 2000s.
In the 2000s.
Okay.
You guys are making me like this movie less the more you talk about it.
Yeah, the timeline is a mess.
The more I think about it, the more I'm beginning to, God dang it, I'm beginning to side with Al even more. I mean, it's just, it's so poorly executed. Like, it's just because I didn't think deeply about the timeline. But now that I'm thinking deeply about the timeline, it wasn't clear. It wasn't clearly articulated. The themes are all over the place. The tone was fine. The acting, again, is really good. I actually think Benicio del Toro is a standout on this.
Oh, yeah. He deserves a definite shout out.
He does everything.
Yeah, I think he's really, really good. But on the directorial side, is this a failure? Like, honestly, because there are great parts. There are great parts. But as a whole, bringing it all together, bringing together the timelines, bringing together the themes, bringing together all the stuff, not on the technical level. On the technical level, Paul Thomas Anderson is always going to be good. But as a movie, a holistic movie, did he fail here?
Let's stop and do some ad reads. It's time to talk about Surfshark VPN. A virtual private network will protect your data, especially when you're on public Wi-Fi. All of your internet activity will be encrypted and passed through one of Surfshark's more than 3,000 servers in 100 countries. This also serves to hide your location so that the sites you visit don't know where you are and therefore who you are unless you explicitly share that information, which means you can bypass any geo restrictions on blocked content. For instance, you can see what Netflix has to offer to people in other countries, which is different than probably what you're seeing. And on the flip side, if you happen to travel to another country, your Disney Plus account, for instance, might just not work. So you want to tell Disney Plus, hey, actually, I'm still in the US. Surfshark's license applies to all of your devices. It is very easy to turn on and off. I like to turn it off when I'm connecting to my bank from my house, because I don't want to confuse my bank and have to prove that it's really me. Your subscription includes 24/7 customer support, and you can make use of other great Surfshark stuff like Surfshark Alert that lets you know if your data has been leaked online. Do not put this off any longer. Surfshark offers a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee, so secure your privacy with Surfshark. Go to surfshark.com/PMP. For 4 extra months of Surfshark, that's surfshark.com/PMP, or use code PMP at checkout to get 4 extra months of Surfshark VPN. If you forget that URL, check the show notes. Movie Struck is a podcast about movies and the people who watch them. Every other week, host Sophia Ricciardi talks to anyone and everyone about a movie of her guest's choosing. We've covered everything from classics like Casablanca to direct-to-DVD toy tie-ins like the Bionicle movies. If it's a movie, it's fair game. MovieStruck is available on all fine podcasting platforms, and if you enjoy the show, check out the MovieStruck Patreon page for bonus written reviews and early previews of upcoming episodes.
I mean, this is time to talk about the rest of his filmography a bit, I think, because what seems weird,
okay,
the rest of his films I've seen, I always come away thinking, like, however much I enjoyed it, I always come away with a very clear idea of what the movie was that Paul Thomas Anderson wanted to make and what he probably wanted me to come away with it.
I agree, yeah.
And what's interesting and distinctive clearly about One Battle After Another is it's an uncharacteristically confused film, or seems like an uncharacteristically confused film.
What? The Master, I'm still not sure what The Master's about.
Oh, The Master was clear. It was very clear.
All right, let's talk about The Master first, yeah, before, because I do think that we might be getting into a Thomas Pynchon rabbit hole with these One Battle After Another and then Inherent Vice. The Master is clearer. The Master is like a novel.
It's very clear.
It sort
very
of struck clear, me like, yeah, Cider House Rules kind of thing, that it's about this guy, and we're really going to show him not all that different than There Will Be Blood in terms of how it's trying to show the evolution of this character over time. You know, it was slow.
Yeah.
But I mostly liked it. I really liked the character himself.
And it commented on Scientology. Like, it's bringing all these things together. I thought The Master was very, like, The Master, There Will Be Blood, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, those are very clear. Like, I'm not confused at all about what he's trying to do with those films.
I mean, even though they're kind of vague in play, like The Master and There Will Be Blood, there's a lot of ambiguity, right? But it feels like it's deliberate ambiguity. It's ambiguity that's supposed to be there for you to kind of sink in.
I think you should be coming out of a movie being able to understand at least one takeaway. And The Master for me was just like, ugh, you set all of this up and then you're not, it doesn't come through for the audience. It doesn't give us a clear message or clear messages. For me, it didn't. I thought the performances were great.
The big message of The Master is Philip Seymour Hoffman's every bit as good as you thought he was.
Well, no, that's not. Okay, it's about a person who is searching, who is adrift and finding, and the way that the master is able to manipulate and give that person meaning, that is very clear to me. And the commenting on Scientology and how people get kind of caught up into that, it's pretty clear, I think. Is it not?
As a buddy movie. The friendship.
Buddy movie. That's not a movie about buddies. They're lovers.
The friendship,
you know it,
between this, you know, ultra civilized fraud and this animal, as he refers to
him.
Yeah,
he's all id. It's like, yes, id ego.
I thought was great, but I can see how you'd see that the ending could have given you more. That it's just the animal has to be free.
It made me so mad.
I'm comfortable with my movies being ambiguous. You know, some of my favorite movies are ambiguous. I'm okay with that.
Are you okay with that, or sometimes you're not sure if you're okay with it or if you're not okay with it?
You know, I'm still working around it. You know, help me to come to, I'm coming to terms with the ambiguity of my ambiguousness and how much I love ambiguousness. But no, honestly, I mean, I'm okay with movies being ambiguous. I'm comfortable with that. Because if a filmmaker is intentionally doing that, okay, I see that, right? What I don't like is when it's ambiguous because the filmmaker fails. That's what I don't like.
Right. I can see that.
Paul Thomas Anderson, when he does the ambiguity in those films, he's intentional about it. He's trying to put the ball in our court and make us kind of come to terms with certain kinds of ideas, yada, 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 right? What I don't like is when it's ambiguous because the director fails, and that's not what he does often. So I'm okay with this one.
So if The Master was trying to do the same kind of thing that There Will Be Blood did successfully, what is, I mean, Al, give your thesis, having seen it so many times, of why There Will Be Blood is such a masterpiece.
So, I mean, again, literary, right? Because it's an incredible character story, first and foremost. But it's also that this character stands in for a whole swathe of huge important themes, like, you know, industry, capitalism, yeah, America, mm-hmm, masculinity, frontiersmanship, family. Daniel Plainview is one of the great American literary figures. He describes a whole, as I said, swathe of American theme culture, whatever you want to say. And it's explored beautifully through all these incredible scenes, which just stick in the memory years and years. Like everybody was scarred by the milkshake I drink. The final scene of that movie is like Citizen Kane level brilliant.
It's a masterwork.
And also, just did anyone else notice in one battle after another, not to return to it hugely, but also another denouement in a very wide open space with two people shouting. And, you know, he just seems to like these echoey rooms that people can flail about in. But yeah, it's that interesting character, and interesting character as an expression of theme, and interest in exploring that through cinematic scenes, and all together it just makes for this insanely powerful experience. And that's before we even get into the incredible choice to have Paul Dano play two characters and just confuse the hell out of everyone completely needlessly for about 25 minutes of your movie. Like, you genuinely don't know whether this is the same guy trying to pull a fast one or if it's genuinely two different people. And it also turns out not to matter that much which of those things is true. And it's just great. That movie is just like nothing else.
Right. And I guess it's such a vivid character study that then one battle after another, I mean, it's not a vivid character. It's what you're going to have the character of the Leo DiCaprio character. Like, he's just a stupid stoner who's on the run.
He's not important enough.
Yeah, he's the Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
He is. In a dirty bathroom.
And I really like the French Connection-esque comedy that they almost made, which was just about, like, Leonardo DiCaprio as, you know, past it revolutionary guy who has to be on the run and can't quite remember the passwords and is too high to keep up with the cool skateboarding kids and whatever. But it just wasn't the movie that I thought I was getting after the first 15 minutes.
So I have never spent any significant time with Thomas Pynchon as an author. Yeah. Has anybody read any of him, like The Crying of Lot 49 or V?
I've started reading things. I've never finished it.
Yeah, same.
So I feel like that is something that I'll take on as a challenge.
Oh, you're about to be disappointed, man.
Or maybe I won't. We'll see. But from what I understand, One Battle After Another is a very loose take on that. But maybe, you know, Thomas Pynchon might be at fault for what we're complaining about the timeline or whatever. Or it's just that, you know, they like to update things. Paul Thomas Anderson is actually clearly very fine doing period pieces. He seems to love doing period pieces. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure why this couldn't just be, don't have cell phones, just have the past be the 60s or, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, and then the now be the 90s or whatever. And it just would have simplified things.
I don't know. I mean, I think from what I've read is that I think he was sort of a little bit muddy about the timeline, because it could be the story present with the daughter could be today, but it also could be in the future. So it was also, it could be either 15 years ago or 15 years ahead, but it was really, I think the way that he did it, he was trying to be a little bit ambiguous about the timeline. Here we are bringing in ambiguity again, but because he wanted to make it extremely current, that this is something that we either should be doing or thinking about right now. And I think he was deliberately making a piece that he wanted it to speak to our immediate issues that we're dealing with here in the States.
But he failed.
Well, that's up for debate. I don't think this is a total failure. I think this is what his attempt was. I don't think this movie is a failure.
Absolutely not. I wouldn't describe it as a failure at all, but it has significant weaknesses and really confusing weaknesses. And the choice of timeline is one of those.
Yeah.
Because you could absolutely make a timely action movie that was, you know, based in the 80s with flashbacks to the 60s and 70s. It's very hard to make that kind of timeless movie when so much of the action of your third act has to revolve around who doesn't have a cell phone. Like, just ignore that bit. Just set it before cell phones. Save yourself the whole trouble. It's confusing.
I mean, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that the movie's a failure, but I do think he failed in some of the areas. You know, so it's very, like, so for example, my beloved Dodgers just won the World Series and they beat the Phillies on the path to do so.
Boo.
So screw it.
Boo, boo, boo.
Screw it, Philadelphia. In that last series, in the actual World Series, Shohei Ohtani failed in many ways, but it was not a failure, the effort. And so that's what I'm saying. Like, in this particular, Al, did that analogy work? Did you like that analogy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, congratulations on the world, winning the World Series.
Thank you so much.
How many other countries competed again?
Well, Japan Canada. Certainly.
We're not going to have this conversation.
Japan certainly did. Don't start with me, Al, because there's nobody from the UK who could do shit in baseball. Anyway, but the point, though, is that this is a really well-made movie. So I wouldn't call it a failure, but I do think he's failed in some of the key areas that he wanted to achieve. It's not like a crash-level failure. I just expected more from Paul Thomas Anderson. His last three films, honestly, have been a little misfires for me. You know, so Licorice Pizza, didn't love it. Inherent Vice, I still don't understand what was going on with that movie.
Okay, so yeah, let's finish the Pynchon-esque thing. That Inherent Vice, from what I understand, is a closer adaptation of the Thomas Pynchon novel. And I listened to I will refer people to the Very Bad Wizards podcast that they, in light of One Battle After Another, they recorded a little bit on One Battle After Another, and then a lot on Inherent Vice that they love. And one of them has watched it 8 times or something ridiculous like that.
That person gets high.
I found it tedious, so tedious, impossible to follow. Obviously, there's a lot of great character actors in there doing fun things. You know, there were some nice moments, which I will give away a little bit at the end, that the Owen Wilson character kind of gets to reunite with his family, and this is a big thing. But like, he'd appeared like 3 times in the whole film for maybe a total of 5 minutes. You don't expect me to care that much about this character if you're going to have it just such a wandering maze of bullshit. And from what I understand, if you read the book,
it's very close to the book, maybe.
This is something that can be with repeated, like, because I kind of do maybe want to see it again at some point. I didn't hate it that much, because I am intrigued. I'm willing to say, because this is the only one that I thought was a real fail. I liked The Master just fine. I had watched it the second time. I wasn't intending to watch it a second time because I've seen it in the last decade, but especially now having the perspective of his larger oeuvre, I really appreciated that. But this one, I just don't get. And I figure it's probably my fault. If there's one film among his whole catalog that you don't get, it must be your fault.
You know what, though? Inherent Vice, I watched it yesterday thinking I had seen it. This was the first time I was watching it. And Josh said, no, we saw this when it came out in the movie theater. And I totally forgot about that. And he's like, don't worry, you're going to forget about this movie again. And I think it's a beautiful film. The way that it's shot, it's so yummy to look at. But that movie, yeah, too many characters. It was all over the place.
That's the Pynchon book that I tried to read because I saw the movie and I did not get it. I did not understand it. I didn't like it. It was very abrasive to me. All the Paul Thomas Anderson touches, like the camera, the cinematography, all stuff, that was wonderful. But the story made no sense to me. So I tried to read that and I got about 100-150 pages in. And I was like, I'm done with this. I can't do this book. You know, so, and he followed the book very carefully. So I think that is more a Pynchon problem. Here's the thing. Do we want our directors to take these kinds of novels and make it their own? Or do we want our directors to take these kinds of novels and follow the way that the author intended it to be? That's the question here.
Whichever's better, whichever works best.
Yeah, I can't make that choice. And also depends on what the novel is.
And who the director is.
This Very Bad Wizards discussion was positing that like whole characters might just be in his head. And is this a thing that like was in the book, or is this something that he added? I don't know.
I didn't get that far, honestly, so I'm not really sure. But when it comes to that particular book, Paul Thomas Anderson needed to take a little bit more of a firm hold on the material and make it work better, because the book is way too wandering, way too obtuse to kind of tell a good film story, I think.
Joaquin Phoenix's character is stoned or high on something the entire time. And I just find that inherently boring. I don't want to be in the brain of somebody who is on something. It's not interesting. I don't think that's an interesting take.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was a comparable one.
Yeah, I don't want to see that.
I actually love that movie.
This movie and One Battle After Another, and actually I enjoyed One Battle After Another, I came out of that movie theater feeling kind of high a little bit. I felt like I was on drugs, but in a good way with One Battle After Another. But with Inherent Vice, I just was like, I don't know. I feel like I need to maybe take a dry day today.
Maybe shift to romance. So we have Punch Drunk Love that, well, most of us liked. Did you like
Punch Drunk Love? Punch Drunk Love,
Punch Drunk Love's great. Yeah.
Anybody who doesn't like Punch Drunk Love, I'm going to punch you. Like, I love that movie.
It's a living monument to the fact that Adam Sandler just doesn't try in most of his other movies.
I agree.
He's more than capable of making a great, being in a great movie.
He is so good. Well, I mean, he was good in Uncut Gems. Like, he was really good in that. But, like, most of the time, he doesn't try very hard.
Well, why should he? He's making bank, you know? Like, why? Like, he should.
I mean, if he wants to be an artist.
I mean, if he collaborates with the right person and he wants to put in the effort, then great, he can. But also, at the same time, you know, he can do paycheck movies are just fine, too. He has a family to raise, and he has girls he needs to send to college.
His family is fine. That dude he needs to take more artistic risks because he has so much talent.
Happy Gilmore.
He has so much ability. And I want to see him really kind of capitalize on that because that's the first film where I saw him and I was like, this guy can really do it. Like, he can really genuinely act if he wanted to. The issue is that he just doesn't want to that much.
The early scene where he's going to the road to get the harmonium, the pump organ, where they show you every single step of him going out and coming back. But yet I still loved it. I don't know if it was because there's music, because it's like those early scenes in about the, with the oil. With the, you know,
there will be blood.
Oh, yeah.
Probably not, because it's just people walking. I'm willing to put myself in a relaxed state and enjoy this in a way that maybe is more effort for some other filmmakers who have this style. Because it's offset with the comedy, and that's we didn't really even talk in one battle after the other about the comedy element. That, you know, it's very
funny.
Yes, the mixing. It's not Coen Brothers the way he mixes it with violence. It's its own thing. Real comes out really clearly in Boogie Nights.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
that's another great film.
It's like Tarantino approaching Coen Brothers absurd. That's where I'd kind of pitch it, because there's that kind of weirdly cerebral absurdism, but also a real joyful love of like exploitation schlock kind of themes.
Yeah, and violent.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what to make of the woman in Punch Drunk Love who...
Oh, Emily Watson's character?
...is just enamored with him and sort of continues to be enamored with him almost whatever he does. And we don't get to see her fall in love because she's already in love with him before she's even met him. And so it just becomes like, can this completely antisocial, or that's not quite the word, but, you know, socially unskilled character not fuck things up? Yeah, he's got
social anxiety.
I mean, I read that there's a lot of autism going on in that film between those two characters. I've kind of seen that happen before, actually. Like, I've kind of seen...
It's like a Benny and June situation.
Yeah, I've kind of seen that happen, you know, so I wasn't that taken aback by it. Now, the first time I saw it, I didn't understand it, but having lived a little bit more, because I was in high school when it came out, I was a young buck when it came out, but having lived a little bit more, I began to realize, okay, I've kind of seen that happen before. I know people who are together now who kind of met in that kind of weird kind of way, and they're both autistic, and they have great relationships now, you know, so it happens.
Absolutely.
And you said you didn't like Licorice Pizza, which has 90% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Didn't like it at all.
And I thought it was fine. I thought it was another kind of interesting character and a challenging sort of romance that, like, you know, you're not going to identify it with it in the way that a romantic comedy will serve things up to you, that this character is not autistic, but is precocious. Let's say that, you know, this young person, he's starting businesses. He's like a full on salesman. And he just thinks that as a 15-year-old that he can just swoop in and sweet talk. Like, can you imagine somebody being that self-confident at that age or at all, really?
Yes, they do exist. They do exist.
Yeah, that's Al Baker. That's the guy who does this kind of stuff.
No, I liked Licorice Pizza just fine, but it was also just like, it seems like kind of a minor.
It's definitely PTA a minor. It's definitely effort, minor. Yeah.
You know?
And it's not that I had a problem with the movie. It's just that it's Paul Thomas Anderson, and I didn't expect him to do something that small and that insignificant. It seemed beneath him, honestly.
And overly long for what it was.
Yes.
Like, it should have been more like Punch Drunk Love. Like, just punch it.
Exactly.
But it has, again, this sort of, it seemed like Cider House Rules or something like that was an adaptation. It's not. It's an original story. So, it's a little unclear to me why they had to put that much of his business journey, for instance, in the film, and is going from one business to another. It just seemed a little off topic for establishing this relationship, if that's really the point.
It seemed like such a nostalgia trip. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was fun for me, again, as somebody who had spent some time in the Valley. It was fun to see the Valley painted in that in that light.
So then Phantom Thread, I thought, Lawrence, you said initially you were not impressed with that one.
Initially, no. Like the first time I saw it, because I think my issue was that there was so much hype about that film that when I saw it, I was expecting this great, and that's probably more of a me problem. I was expecting this really great knock my socks off, you know, film. And the performances are great in that film, like legitimately great. Mm-hmm. But I was expecting more. Honestly, the more I've watched it, because I've seen it 3 times since I watched it that first time, the more I've watched it, I've kind of come to appreciate it a great deal more, understand what was going on with that film, really appreciate the production design, the costuming, the acting, all the kind of stuff, a little bit more of the direction, much more. But initially, I didn't love it as much as other people did.
I hadn't even heard of the film before.
Oh, you hadn't?
We went into this.
Oh.
So
that was a huge Oscar film. That was a huge Oscar film.
I mean, yeah. Maybe it just that says more about me and my out of touchness than anything else. Yeah, Sarah, what did you think of this?
What I thought was interesting, this is a movie that doesn't take place in California. It takes place in Great Britain. I would have loved to have heard an interview or something about why he chose to do a story that was set in England with these characters. But I loved those characters. I loved all three leads actually in this film. And I loved the whole theme. And I loved, this was actually a movie where you have female characters with some agency who are making some pretty bold choices. And I really appreciated that.
Did anybody ever see the movie, The Accidental Tourist?
Yes.
Yeah, of course I did.
So I feel like this was a subversion of that for folks that don't. So that was like, William Hurt is an uptight travel writer, and he runs into Gina Davis, the woman who opens his eyes, and he has to consider, you know. And so this is a similar thing, but it's a really fucked up version of this. This Daniel Day-Lewis just playing his There Will Be Blood and this performance back to back. Like, God damn it. I mean, there's a reason that he's just considered so amazing. Like, you would just not think that this is the same person at all.
No.
And I played just that little clip of him reacting to, it's toward the end, where his sister is saying, you know, maybe your clothes aren't considered chic. And he's like, chic, don't use that dirty word. Like, that. It hurts my feelings. And I just thought that was a beautiful little scene and display of that character. But
he's such a whiny baby.
Yeah, but that he doesn't just like open up to this woman that comes into his life. I guess I could spoil it a little bit, but
don't spoil it too much.
Yeah, maybe should I not spoil that? I bet a lot of people haven't seen it. It seems highly dysfunctional.
I didn't get around to watching Phantom Thread, but just hearing you guys talk about it makes me feel like I really want to.
I think you'll like it.
Okay, I won't spoil it for you, Alan.
You will like it.
Yeah, it's great. But it is like, he is just another kind of whiny baby, like man-child.
You're so mean, Sarah. Oh my gosh.
That's his specialty. That's Paul Thomas Anderson's.
Yeah, no, he loves, I never thought of this before, but that's what he loves popping the whiny man baby egos. He's like the anti, who's the guy that we, Oppenheimer.
Christopher Nolan.
He's the anti-Christopher Nolan. So he takes Leonardo DiCaprio and shows him to be the ridiculous figure that he is instead of trying to make him look cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess those are all the romances. But Boogie Nights, we haven't really considered. You know, Epic Scope, had you seen the early version of Boogie Nights? Anybody seen?
Oh, the Dirk Diggler.
Yes. Story? It was like his student film that he did. I couldn't find it anywhere on YouTube or anything like that.
I think it is on YouTube. I didn't watch it. I didn't have time to watch it because it was like 30 minutes long. But apparently it is done in the style of like an interview. So it's basically kind of like they're talking about Dirk Diggler behind his back. You know, all of these characters come in and talk about sort of this legend of the porn scene. And he films it kind of like in the style, I think it was done in 88. So there are all these television shows that were doing like investigative reporting, you know, with interviewing, you know, people about certain things. And so anyway, so that was sort of the style that he chose to shoot it in. And it was interesting because I listened to him talk about how he started it basically in 88 and Boogie Nights came out in 97. So he had been working on it for 9 or 10 years, the same story, trying to figure out how to to tell that story of this character. And it's interesting that he started over here with, you know, interview style, which was, you know, a cheap thing to do. I understand why you would start there. And then he ended up with over here with this full story about him starring him. So anyway, and apparently Leonardo DiCaprio was thinking about playing Dirk Diggler before Mark Wahlberg, Marky Mark, took on the role.
I think Mark Wahlberg is great in that film as Dirk Diggler.
Yeah.
I think Leonardo DiCaprio probably regrets not doing that job more than anyone else does.
No, I don't think so. Because it was either that or...
Was it that or Titanic?
Titanic, yeah. So yeah, okay. I think
everyone's fine.
But I keep thinking about that scene when Mark Wahlberg is like trying to sing in Boogie Nights.
Oh, that's so great. That is so great.
That 80 thing. It is... one of my all-time favorite scenes. Like, it makes me laugh every single time I think about it.
Yeah, I love that tracking shot from the beginning where at the party where they've got, you know, him coming in and what's his name is making margaritas and just that whole, I could watch that over and I have watched that opening shot over and over and over again. I love this movie so much. That's why I was so mad at Magnolia when it came out 2 years later.
Magnolia is so good. I do not understand why you don't like Magnolia.
No, I just want to say I had no idea that Boogie Nights is based on a student film, and I just really, it makes me warm to the guy so much that he had so much creative attachment to this, like, story about the depravity of the porn scene in the, is it the 70s or the 80s?
Yes, it's
70s
to the
80s,
yeah.
70s to the 80s. And it just, he was so attached, because it must have taken, like, no one gets their student film picked up and turned into a proper production, right? That just never happens. How much work he would have put into realizing this vision just makes you really warm to the guy.
Yeah, I have no idea about that.
Well, it reminds me so much of, like, you know, novel writing. When people are writing, myself included, yeah, are writing their first novel, it can take years and years and years. And that's where you figure out how to write a novel. And it, to me, it sounds like, oh, this is how he figured out how to make a movie, you know?
And we got to give props to John C. Reilly as another staple.
John C. Reilly.
His work has never been better than in Paul Thomas Anderson movies, I feel like.
Never been better than in Magnolia, which Sarah clearly doesn't like, and she's wrong about.
Yeah, let's talk about it. I want to talk about Magnolia.
That movie is so good. It is so good.
Give us your pitch. Why is it good?
Because it is. Give me a pitch about why it isn't. You give me your pitch.
It's too long. It's self-indulgent. It's not too many characters.
It is. No.
Too many storylines. You could have cut out two or three storylines and chopped it down to less than 2 hours.
It is a series of short stories, like glimpses, like The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. But like, let's do six of those. But they have interesting resonances with each other, and they're staggered in a way that, to me, makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can say that the thing that happens at the end that sort of is divine intervention and makes not a lot of sense is a little silly. The fact that they're all singing the Amy Mann song together, like that.
That was the best part of that movie, is the soundtrack.
Is the quintessential Paul Thomas Anderson moment for me, is when they're all singing this, even though it makes not a lot of sense, but it says there's an emotional resonance. There's so much sadness in the world, I guess, is what it comes down to. And I thought so many of those individual vignettes were wonderful. And the way that the thing ended, actually, like, I teared up a little bit, you know, with John C. Reilly presenting this.
I full on cried.
Explaining to this woman who has been abused by her father, who he's trying to be romantic with. And you can't even hear what he's saying, right? It's because it's just music playing over it. And then she smiles at the end, and that's the end of the movie. And like, I just thought that was amazing. Like, did it need the thing at the beginning, which was saying, look, there's lots of weird coincidences. Like, it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was necessary. I guess it was an okay kind of bookend.
Patton Oswalt, before he was Patton Oswalt.
Let me go deep into this. Okay, so Raymond Carver is one of my favorite short story writers of all time. I love him. Mm-hmm. And I love Robert Altman's Shortcuts, which is a collection of Raymond Carver short stories put to film. And Magnolia is definitely in that tradition. Now, what Magnolia does better than that film, it's very propulsive. Like, you glide through that film. And when it slows down to have these emotional moments. Like, when Tom Cruise is crying over his father, who is dying, about to die.
Yep.
Like, the film stops for that.
Great scene.
Because it is, like, letting you know this is an important scene. But otherwise, the film is going, going, going. Now, the end part of it where there's some kind of weird thing that happens that's been foreshadowed, because there's been a Bible verse has been kind of really kind of put through the entire film, if you're paying attention to the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's weird. But honestly, like, the fact that all these stories are interconnected, the fact that all these stories are telling human stories, emotional stories. What's her name?
Julianne Moore.
Julianne Moore. She's really good. You know, and she's absolutely good.
She's terrible in that movie.
She is not terrible in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know what? She is not terrible in that movie. She is unbelievably good in that movie. Now, she overacts in one of those scenes, but the emotional kind of through line between that film is that we all mess up, we all make mistakes, and the mistakes that we make, they echo through time and they impact all these different individuals. And I thought that was a wonderful way to put that on screen. And I'm sorry, Sarah, like, you can hate this film all you want. It is a legitimately great film. And honestly, it kind of catapulted PTA into a position where he's able to make these different kinds of films, because people saw that with Boogie Nights, with Heartache, and then with this, he was able to do this. And it may be not Sarah's taste, but listener, I'm telling you, find that film, watch it, you will enjoy it. Don't listen to Sarah, she's wrong.
I'm not saying don't watch it. I've seen it now a couple of times, and I don't regret it. There are certain parts of that movie that are fantastic. I mean, I don't know that Tom Cruise has ever been better in anything, you know, that he brought out a performance in Tom Cruise that is absolutely stellar. He should have won an Oscar that year.
It's that and A Few Good Men. Those are his good roles.
Yeah.
He's been good in other stuff. Come on, Al. You're killing me. He's been good in other stuff.
Julianne Moore's character is off. I mean, there were actually, it seemed like, how many, like, old men dying of cancer do we need? How many do we need strung out beautiful women? It was just too much. I wished that movie could have been great, and it's not.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is great in that film as well.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was perfection in that movie. Yeah,
he's really good. John C. Reilly was good in that film. I think Philip Baker Hall was good in that
film.
I think William H. Macy and his braces kind of guy, he's good in that film. I'm sorry, man. That film has a lot to recommend it.
There's some stuff to recommend, but still, there's a lot that needed to be cut.
One thing I will say, that it's early Paul Thomas Anderson, and at that point, he hadn't really figured out, I don't know if he's ever really figured out, like, the female character. He hasn't figured that out yet in this film. So you're right, it's very male-centric, it's very heavy on that. But otherwise, man, I mean, it's got some shortcomings to be sure, but I think it's great.
So I think that's a good thing about Licorice Pizza, actually, is that the female character in there is pretty thoroughly threshed out. Is why would this 25-year-old be ultimately seduced by this very young, maybe she's 22, anyway, way too old for him, an adult, be seduced by this young person. And I don't want to spoil the film, but, you know, the things she witnesses and things she goes through that make her, you know, she really resisted for a long time. Like, this is a film that my wife would not watch with me, because she's just like, that is a gross premise. I don't want to see this fantasized, you know, glorified child abuse, basically, case. But it's so not presented that way, that it's a long journey before they legitimately can get together, of realizing some kind of philosophical stuff. Life's too short. We are probably not going to be with the one you love. So much tragedy. Like, well, heck, we might as well do this thing. Admit these feelings that we have. I liked, like, Heather Graham as Roller Girl, but they aren't fleshed out main characters. They're similar to the One Battle After Another issue of, like, this is a very vivid character, the love interest in Punch Drunk Love, like a very vivid character, a very likable character, but not one that is centered such that you can actually make sense of her.
I thought that in Phantom Thread, I thought that she was...
She was
actually a really strong character.
That's true. That's true. Absolutely true. Because she is the one who actually has emotions and is flexible and is dealing with this situation. So, so I think it's something he's maybe gotten better at over time.
I don't know. I mean, One Battle After Another.
The daughter.
That's what I was going to say. Will is great, but the supposedly like main motivating character of the movie is this weird caricature.
Yep. All right, we got to shut down, but I think even just, I'm just looking at the cast of Boogie Nights. We could talk a little more about this in our after talk. For anybody that can stick around, go to patreon.com/prettymuchpop if you want to hear the slightly longer version of all of these episodes, pretty much. But really thank everybody for listening. Hey, we could really use, if you've been enjoying this, if you're a regular listener, go to Apple Podcasts, go to Spotify, give us a nice 5-star review, write us a nice rating, you know.
If you don't, I think you're a hater. Give us a 5-star review. Come on, guys.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.